The sun was setting on a warm Alabama evening as Anthony Ray Hinton sat in his prison cell contemplating the irony of his situation. For nearly 30 years, he had been confined to a 5-by-7-foot cell on death row for crimes he didn't commit. His story would later become one of the most shocking examples of injustice in American history, catching the attention of millions through Bryan Stevenson's best-selling book, Just Mercy, and the Equal Justice Initiative's tireless advocacy. Oprah Winfrey selected Hinton's memoir for her book club, calling it a powerful testament to the resilience of the human spirit. His case represents everything broken in America's criminal justice system: racial bias, inadequate legal representation, prosecutorial misconduct, and the stubborn refusal of a system to acknowledge its mistakes. Yet, through unimaginable darkness, Hinton's story reveals something profound about the human capacity for hope, forgiveness, and finding light in the darkest places. In the summer of 1985, Anthony Ray Hinton's life changed forever. At 29, he was working at a secure warehouse in Birmingham, Alabama, living with his mother and dreaming of opening his own restaurant someday. He had made mistakes in his youth, including stealing a car he had test-driven for 2 years before being caught, but had served his time and was determined to stay on the right path. On July 25, 1985, Hinton worked the night shift at Bruno's Food Warehouse, cleaning bathrooms and separating broken pallets from good ones in the foggy, humid night. Nothing about this ordinary shift suggested it would be his last taste of freedom for nearly 3 decades. Meanwhile, across town, Sidney Smotherman, an assistant manager at Quincy's restaurant, had survived being shot during a late-night robbery. This shooting was being investigated alongside 2 previous murders of restaurant managers: John Davidson from Mrs. Winner's Chicken and Biscuits in February and Thomas Wayne Vasson from Captain D's in July. Both victims had been shot in the head and left in walk-in coolers during robberies. 6 days later, police officers appeared at Hinton's mother's house in Burnwell. They handcuffed him without explanation, only saying they were taking him to Bessemer. Hinton wasn't afraid. He hadn't done anything wrong and had been following all his parole requirements from his previous offense. He consented to searches of his car and bedroom, certain they'd find nothing incriminating. As they drove him away, he watched his mother crying and stretching her arms toward him from the driveway. He kept telling himself it would be okay, that the truth would set him free, and he'd be home soon. Instead, Hinton was charged with the murders of Davidson and Vasson, as well as the attempted murder of Smotherman. Police claimed they had recovered a .38-caliber pistol from his mother's home that ballistics tests linked to all 3 shootings. Smotherman had allegedly identified Hinton as his attacker. The nightmare had begun, and it would take nearly 30 years to end. From the moment of his arrest, Hinton encountered a system that presumed his guilt rather than his innocence. During his processing at the Bessemer police station, officers attempted to get him to sign a blank piece of paper, claiming they would type his Miranda rights on it later. Hinton refused. During transport, Lieutenant Acker delivered a chilling message that would prove prophetic. "It doesn't matter if you did it or not. If you get tried, you're going to be convicted. You're going to have 5 things against you. You're going to have a white victim. You're going to have a white district attorney. You're going to have a white judge. You're going to have a white jury. And you're going to have a nigger defendant." Counting on his fingers, Acker emphasized, "Conviction, conviction, 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 conviction." Despite his mother's teachings to respect authority and tell the truth, Hinton realized he was being railroaded. The evidence against him was flimsy at best. Police claimed bullets from the murders matched his mother's old .38 pistol, though the gun hadn't been fired in 25 years. They dismissed his work alibi, suggesting he had somehow snuck out of a secured warehouse with guards and locked doors, committed murder, and snuck back in time to clean bathrooms, a timeline that defied logic. When Hinton met his court-appointed attorney, Sheldon Perhacks, he immediately sensed trouble. Perhacks mumbled, "I didn't go to law school to do pro bono work," and dismissed Hinton's claims of innocence with, "All y'all always doing something and saying you're innocent." Despite Perhax's apparent lack of interest, Hinton desperately wanted to believe his lawyer would fight for him. Hinton begged for a polygraph test to prove his innocence. When one was finally administered in May 1986, the examiner concluded, "It is the opinion of this examiner that the subject told the truth during this polygraph examination." Hinton overheard him tell a guard, "If I could go by this test, he would walk out of here with me right now." He showed no signs of deception. Yet prosecutor Bob McGregor reneged on the deal to use these results. The state was determined to convict Hinton regardless of evidence pointing to his innocence. His last hope was finding a ballistics expert to challenge the state's claim that his mother's gun was the murder weapon. But at $15,000, such expertise was beyond his means. Hinton's trial began on September 12, 1986, at the Jefferson County Courthouse. The prosecution's case rested heavily on testimony from Reginald Payne White, someone Hinton had known casually for years. Reggie and Hinton had a history. Hinton had once dated two sisters simultaneously, one of whom Reggie was interested in. Now, years later, Reggie was getting $5,000 in reward money to help convict Hinton. On the stand, Reggie claimed Hinton had deliberately sought information about Quincy's restaurant, asking about closing times and the manager's new Fiero car. The prosecution used this to suggest Hinton was planning the robbery. Throughout his testimony, Reggie avoided looking directly at Hinton. When Perhax cross-examined him, he failed to expose Reggie's motives or mention the reward money he stood to gain. The ballistics evidence was equally problematic. Hinton's defense expert, Andrew Payne, testified that the bullets couldn't have come from Hinton's mother's gun. However, the prosecution systematically dismantled Payne's credibility, revealing he had only one eye, didn't know how to operate the comparison microscope properly, and even needed help turning on the light. When Payne dropped bullets and couldn't properly use the equipment, Hinton looked over at his attorney in disbelief. Hadn't Perhax vetted this witness? The humiliation continued as the prosecutor showed Payne's slides came from a 1956 firearms book that ironically contained a section called The Charlatans, describing unqualified experts who would cheerfully swear away the life of an innocent man. When Payne held up his measuring scale, described in the book as a charlatan's tool, he seemed oblivious to how badly he was being discredited. It took the jury just 2 hours to find Hinton guilty and 45 minutes to sentence him to death. Before Judge Garrett read his sentence, Hinton told the court, "One day the truth will come out. You can take my life, but you sure can't take my soul. That belongs to God." After sentencing, Hinton was transported to Holman Prison, known as the House of Pain and the Slaughter Pen of the South. Chained and shackled from head to toe, he was processed as inmate number Z468 and placed in a small cell, 5 feet wide, 7 feet long, with just a metal toilet sink combo, a shelf, and a bed. Initially, he threw his Bible under the bed, feeling God had forsaken him. Life on death row was brutal and dehumanizing. Meals came at bizarre hours, breakfast at 3 a.m., lunch at 10 a.m., and dinner at 2 p.m. The food was barely edible, powdered eggs, rock-hard biscuits, mysterious meat patties rumored to be horse meat, and metallic-tasting canned vegetables. Showers offered no privacy, with guards, even female ones, watching as prisoners rushed through scalding hot or freezing cold water in under 2 minutes. Death row was haunted by the ghosts of executed men and suicides. The sounds at night were like a horror movie. Rats scratching, roaches swarming, men crying, screaming, or laughing maniacally. Hinton barely slept more than 15 minutes at a stretch, pushing him toward madness. The most horrific aspect of death row was witnessing executions. The death chamber was just 30 feet from Hinton's cell. When Wayne Ritter was executed on August 28, 1987, the smell of burned flesh permeated the cells, causing Hinton to dry heave for days. There was no escaping the putrid hair of death that settled into his hair, throat, and mouth. A guard mockingly told complaining inmates they'd get used to it since they'd smell the same way someday. The death squad, 12 guards who formed the execution team, would practice their grim ritual months before each execution, marching solemnly down the row to the death chamber. When Michael Lindsay, a 28-year-old inmate in the cell below Hinton's, was taken to be executed, inmates throughout the prison banged on bars and doors, wanting him to know he wasn't alone. Hinton slammed his fist against his cell door until it was raw and later wept under his blanket after smelling Lindsay's death. During his time on death row, Hinton would witness the executions of 54 men, each one bringing him closer to confronting his own mortality. After years of anger and despair, Hinton made a pivotal decision. He would not let his circumstances destroy his humanity. He approached Warden Charlie Jones with a proposal for a book club, explaining that giving inmates something to focus on besides death would keep them peaceful. Hinton negotiated for 6 inmates to meet monthly with books sent from outside. Their first book club meeting included 7 men seated at separate tables in the library, discussing James Baldwin's Bo Tell It on the Mountain. The awkwardness was palpable, especially for Larry and Henry, the only white members. Henry, a former KKK member who had lynched a black teenager, shared a passage about racial hatred being taught by fathers, revealing his shame and transformation. Despite their diverse backgrounds and crimes, they found common ground in literature, briefly escaping their grim reality. The book club transformed death row. Books circulated between cells with discussions shouted from tier to tier, providing a rare space where opinions were respected. When Jimmy Dill asked to borrow Hinton's copy of To Kill a Mockingbird, it reinforced the power of literature to connect even the most isolated souls. Hinton's kindness extended beyond the book club. When Henry's racist father, Benny Hayes, collapsed during a visit and later died, inmates throughout death row passed their precious commissary items down the row as comfort food for Henry, showing that even in this hellish place, they could create family from anyone. One night, hearing another inmate sobbing uncontrollably after learning his mother had died, Hinton broke through his own isolation to offer comfort. Other inmates joined in, offering condolences, creating an unexpected community of compassion. Through this act of reaching out, Hinton realized Alabama could take his freedom, but not his humanity or sense of humor. Everything, he realized, is a choice, and spending your days just waiting to die is no way to live. After 12 years on death row, Hinton's legal situation seemed hopeless. His court-appointed attorney had abandoned him after his initial appeals were denied, demanding $15,000 to continue representation before the U.S. Supreme Court, an impossible sum for Hinton's impoverished family. In desperation, Hinton reached out to Brian Stevenson at the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, an organization known for taking on death row cases that others had abandoned. When they finally met face-to-face in the stark visitation room at Holman Prison, Hinton felt an immediate connection, like he could take a deep breath for the first time in over 12 years. Brian had compassion in his eyes, a kind of understanding that showed he knew the hell Hinton had been living through. Unlike previous attorneys who seemed distant and detached, Stevenson sat close and maintained eye contact, showing genuine concern for Hinton's humanity. Hinton poured out everything about his unwavering claims of innocence, his mother's unconditional love that sustained him through the darkest days, the fundamentally rigged trial that denied him expert witnesses, and the psychological torture of living on death row while smelling his friends burn during executions. He described the sounds, the smells, and the emotional trauma of knowing 54 men who were executed during his time there. Brian listened intently for hours without interruption or judgment, taking detailed notes. When Hinton suggested getting an honest, racist, Southern white expert for ballistics testing, reasoning that such testimony would be more credible to an Alabama jury, Brian smiled and agreed it was a strategically sound approach. Brian's investigation made remarkable progress where others had failed. He tracked down Hinton's supervisor, Tom Dahl, who provided strong support for his alibi, located former co-workers who testified to Hinton's character and whereabouts, and interviewed his mother and numerous church members who had known him his whole life. Most crucially, he secured three renowned ballistics experts, good old boys from Texas, and a former FBI specialist who conclusively determined that the bullets from the crime scenes could not have been fired from Hinton's mother's gun. Their advanced analysis revealed major flaws in the state's case. They also discovered that the state's experts had worksheets with question marks and missing information they had never disclosed to the defense attorney, a serious Brady violation that undermined the entire prosecution. By February 2002, after 16 grueling years on death row, Brian was deep in negotiations with the Jefferson County District Attorney, methodically building the case to join a motion to vacate Hinton's conviction. The truth was finally emerging from decades of shadows, and Hinton, despite everything, prayed harder than ever before, even for Judge Garrett, McGregor, and others who had wronged him. Through his faith and personal growth, he had come to forgive them. Their sins, he believed, were between them and God. His mother had taught him that bitterness would only poison his own soul. Despite compelling evidence of Hinton's innocence, the legal system moved at an agonizingly slow pace. After a Rule 32 hearing, where Brian brilliantly argued that their evidence wasn't just a battle of experts, but proof of innocence, Judge Garrett ruled against Hinton. Brian immediately appealed to the Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals. In June 2006, the Court of Criminal Appeals denied Hinton's appeal in a 3-2 decision. Though disappointed, Hinton found hope in those two dissenting judges, the first time any judges had sided with him in his case. His case bounced between courts for years, from the Alabama Supreme Court back to Circuit Court, where Judge Petro replaced the retired Judge Garrett. In 2009, Petro issued what Brian called a bizarre ruling that failed to properly address whether the defense's original ballistics expert was qualified. By 2013, after 27 years on death row, Hinton was exhausted. He faced a pivotal decision with Brian about their legal strategy. They could pursue federal habeas corpus with limited scope but years of potential litigation, or take his innocence claim directly to the Supreme Court now, risking acceleration of his execution if they lost. After reflection, Hinton chose the Supreme Court path. "I want them to know I'm innocent," he told Brian. "I don't think I can be here until I'm 70 years old and still be fighting." He was prepared for either outcome, even execution, knowing his last words would be, "I am innocent." In February 2014, after months of waiting, Brian called with stunning news. The Supreme Court had issued a unanimous ruling in Hinton's favor without even hearing oral arguments. They concluded his trial attorney had provided constitutionally deficient representation and vacated the lower court's judgment. For the first time in 29 years, Hinton saw a flicker of hope. The legal process continued with renewed momentum after the Supreme Court victory. The Alabama Court of Criminal Appeals formally sent Hinton's case back to Jefferson County Circuit Court, where Judge Laura Petro carefully reviewed and ultimately granted his Rule 32 petition in September 2014. By January, a new trial was scheduled with Brian Stevenson serving as his lead attorney, marking a critical turning point in Hinton's three-decade fight for justice. When the day came for Hinton to leave death row, he methodically distributed all his earthly possessions among the other inmates, books, letters, and small items that had sustained him through the years. In a powerful moment of solidarity, he addressed his fellow inmates one final time, urging them to never abandon hope regardless of their circumstances. The scene that followed was extraordinary. Dozens of men, all facing death sentences themselves, began chanting "Hinton, Hinton" in a thunderous chorus that echoed through the concrete corridors as he walked off the row clutching his birth certificate, the only possession he kept. On April 1, 2015, while adjusting to life in county jail awaiting his new trial, Hinton received an unexpected call from Brian Stevenson. The news was almost impossible to believe. Jefferson County District Attorney Brandon Falls had reviewed the evidence and decided to drop all charges. Hinton, thinking of the date, repeatedly asked Brian if this was an April Fool's prank, his voice trembling with emotion. Brian assured him it was real. After 30 years, Hinton would finally walk free that Friday. The day of release arrived bright and clear. Hinton carefully dressed in the new clothes Brian had brought him, a crisp blue shirt and black suit that replaced his prison uniform. As he walked through the jail doors, he was met by a sea of cameras, journalists, and supporters, but his eyes sought out his family, his sisters who had aged during his absence, nieces he had never met, and Lester Bailey, the friend who had visited him faithfully for 3 decades. Looking skyward, Hinton spoke the words that would later become the title of his memoir, "The Sun Does Shine." His first day of freedom was a complex mixture of euphoria and overwhelming confusion. He visited his mother's grave at Shadow Lawn Cemetery, speaking to her about finally achieving the freedom she had prayed for but didn't live to see. The modern world proved challenging. He was baffled by GPS navigation in cars, and at a restaurant, he watched in confusion as Lester paid with a small plastic card, having never seen debit card technology. That first night, sleeping in Lester's guest room, he sank into what felt like an impossibly soft mattress, his mind still echoing with the familiar sounds of death row. The clanking of metal doors, guards' footsteps, and the murmur of men living in the shadow of death, sounds that had been his constant companions for 30 years. Freedom brought its own challenges as Hinton adjusted to a world that had moved on without him for 30 years. The soft bed at Lester's house felt uncomfortable compared to his cell, and he had a panic attack, finding comfort only when he locked himself in the bathroom, a space similar in size to his cell. Hinton now lives in his mother's old house, repaired after years of abandonment. He travels with Brian Stevenson, telling his story to help end the death penalty. Though he's met celebrities and traveled the world, he would trade it all for his 30 years back, or one more minute with his mother. Remarkably, Hinton has forgiven everyone involved in his wrongful conviction. "I have no hatred for anyone, not for the police officers, not for the witnesses who lied, not for the prosecutor, not for the judge," he writes. Yet the trauma remains. He still creates alibis daily, documenting his whereabouts out of fear it could happen again. Hinton's story is a powerful testament to the resilience of the human spirit and a damning indictment of America's criminal justice system. His case exemplifies everything wrong with capital punishment: racial bias, inadequate legal representation, prosecutorial misconduct, and a system more concerned with finality than justice. Death row taught Hinton that how we live matters, whether we choose love or hate, help or harm. The choices we make define us, even when we can't see how our lives might change forever. As he often tells audiences now, the sun does shine. Even when you can't see it, it's still there. In the afterword to his memoir, Hinton lists hundreds of names, people currently on death row across America. This powerful device transforms statistics into human beings with names, forcing readers to confront the reality that each represents a person whose life hangs in the balance of our imperfect justice system. He challenges readers to say innocent after every 10th name, knowing statistically that's how many wrongfully convicted people are on this list. Anthony Ray Hinton's journey from death row to freedom reminds us that justice is fragile, that systems fail, but that hope, forgiveness, and human dignity can survive even in the darkest places. His story continues to inspire reform efforts nationwide and stands as a powerful reminder that behind every death sentence is a human being with a story that deserves to be heard.